you may have planned to go into teaching. I don't know. I did not.
I did not.
I had not planned to go into teaching at all. And I hadn't really looked hard for a job because I knew I could get one coming off of the Supreme Court. The market was good. And I got a call in February telling me that, that I don't remember the guy's name, but a professor had resigned effective the following fall. And they asked me whether I would have any interest, as a phone call, whether I would have any interest in talking to them about teaching for a couple of years. And I said, yeah, let's talk about it. So I made a trip down here, and I visited with Ted Mearns and Lindsay Cowan, I think it was, at that point. I don't know whether I ever talked to Hardy or not. Hardy was dean then. And, you know, we basically sealed the deal on the visit. Mm-hmm. And so exactly as Dick described, it was totally informal.
I mean, I came to law school thinking I'd go back to Richmond and put my native, where I was born and raised, where I thought I'd go back and practice. And then my wife didn't really care to go back to Richmond. We compromised on Washington, so I went to Covington and Burling. And then at Covington, my best friend in law school, John Rhinelander,
right,
was editor-in-chief of the Law, had been editor-in-chief of the Law Review, and he was clerking for Justice Harlan. And at that time, before I started clerking, we'd had exactly two people that I'm aware of ever clerked at the Supreme Court, John
and Prettyman.
And,
right,
and Barry Prettyman, right, were the two. Right. There was no tradition of clerking, and it's powerful today, but it hardly existed. So I didn't get the idea of applying for a clerkship until after I graduated.
So Dick would have been the third, and I guess I was the fourth.
You were the fourth, exactly. Right, right. And of course, it's been a regular tradition since then.
And I guess in Rhinelander's case, I don't know about Prettyman, he probably went right straight to the court from law school, as did I. Dick had practiced a couple of years, but I went straight to the court from law school. There was no tradition then of clerking for an intermediate appellate court like there is now.
Exactly.
There were some of my co-clerks or our co-clerks who had clerked at the circuit court level, but that was more coincidence than requirement.
It was not expected.
I mean, you can't imagine.
One ever goes to the Supreme Court without clerking for at least one judge before, increasingly two. And I just applied to all nine, got some interviews.
Yeah.
Black made me an offer, and he was my secret number. I mean, he was the one I wanted to clerk for, but obviously you take whatever offer you get. But it was during my clerking, at that point, between the time I graduated and the time I reported for work, Felix Frankfurter had a stroke and left the court. Arthur Goldberg took his place, and so that vote moved across the spectrum from the conservative wing to the liberal wing, and the balance on the court tipped to Hugo Black's side, and so after all those years of dissent, he was now writing the great majority opinions, and there I was at his elbow, just by chance. So the chance to spend a second year not only with Black, but at that point in the court's history, just
phenomenal. it was a great term to be there. Our term, the second Dick's term. There were a lot of really interesting and exciting things going on, not the least of which was the JFK assassination, which that fall. But in terms of the court's business, there was an awful lot of heady stuff going on.
I imagine you were in your office working as I was in mine when the word came through of the assassination. I still have a note on Hugo Black's stationery. He was obviously they were in conference, and he was writing a note saying, Dick, please go to the library and get me volume whatever of the U.S. reports. He then broke off, and then he completed it by saying, the president has just been shot in Dallas, HLB.
My memory is that the court was in conference. It was an unbroken rule that you never interrupted the conference, but on that occasion they did.
Needless to say.
And I wound up, I don't know whether you did that. I found out about it because my wife called and told me. I wound up at our clerks, and I don't know whether you were there or not, Dick, in Brennan's office because he had a television. And we were all congregating in Brennan's office watching the TV. And, of course, when it happened, we had no clue whether it was a coup or what was going on. I mean, the president was shot. We didn't know whether Johnson had been shot, too. And so the initial reports were just
there we were in the heart of Washington.
That's right, exactly.
On Capitol Hill.
We didn't know whether we were being attacked or what was going on.
In my case, it felt uncanny because the previous year, the year of the Cuban Missile Crisis, at Covington, I was at Ground Zero. My office looked out on Lafayette Square, and I knew that was Ground Zero. I said, at least it'll be quick. But that was a great term, because the not only were the cases important, but the justices felt it. There was air of history being made.
Right.
And so I was bitten by the act working with Black. It sort of infused me with the love of constitutional law, and I felt the chances of going back to practice were becoming less and less.
Yeah, I probably would have wound up in practice if it weren't for that phone call. You would have too, I guess.
Yeah. I think that's right. I had not set out to interview at other law schools or whatever. I figured, if I don't like teaching, I could always go back to Richmond or Washington.
That's exactly what my reasoning was. It looked like it was an interesting opportunity for a year or two.
That's right.
And if I started practicing, I would never get back to teaching. If I started teaching, I could easily, after a year or two, transition into practice. And so it made the choice easy once I had the opportunity. But again, to go back to something Dick said, the informality of the hiring at that time compared to what goes on now is just striking.
I mean, my impression was that Hardy Dillard was the appointments committee.
And
he knew us. We'd been students here, so there wasn't a lot of record to lay before him. And I suspect he just told a couple of other people this hit fine. And there it was. Compared to today's process, it's another world entirely.
Right, exactly.
And people might point to us and say, "There, I told you why we changed the system."
That's right, exactly. Exactly. You know. That's right.
Living proof.
Yeah, which is not to say that that's a better or worse system. It's probably a worse system in many ways, because today's system is much more thorough, and I think it's probably a better system, although I have some criticisms of it here and there, but that's another matter.
It's certainly the way they do it now. It's certainly
a total
change for it. It was a much, not only a smaller law school in those days, but I think a more intimate place.
Absolutely.
I mean, not only did one know all the faculty well, because there were 25 people, but I felt like I knew all the students.
Yeah.
Because the smaller size. The
well, with one exception, though.
One student?
No. At that time, one big exception, actually, at that time, the classes were sectioned alphabetically.
Mm.
And I taught, I don't know what Dick taught his first couple of years, but I taught a first semester, first year course, and a second semester, second year course. And all the classes were required at that point for the first 2 years. So, and I taught the same half of the alphabet in my spring course. And so, you know, I met half of the first-year class my first year, and my second year I met the same half of the first-year class, and I never got to know the other half.
That's a major exception. Everything was by alphabet, but basically.
Yeah, I started with criminal law and procedure, which at that time was 1 4-hour course, and the reason for that is that there really wasn't any criminal procedure at that point. The court was in the process of inventing it, if you will. The granddaddy case that really set off the criminal procedure revolution was decided, I think, in 61, if I remember, Matt.
61.
And so I was, you know, teaching a criminal law and criminal procedure course 3 years later. And so cases like Miranda had not been decided yet. So I had 3 hours of my criminal law course was the substantive criminal law, and then 1 hour was procedure. And then I taught a commercial law course in the spring. I taught it because they needed somebody to teach it, and I told them I'd teach whatever they needed. So, and that didn't take. I taught that for 2 years and then quit it and stayed with criminal law. And then later I picked up constitutional law, among other courses. And I don't know where you started.
But, well, you know, your comment reminds me of the not-so-gentle fiction that operated in those days, which was that any faculty member could teach any subject except maybe tax. Tax might have been the one thing that was thought to be specialized, but... Yeah. Peter has suggested they threw him into commercial law. I taught constitutional law, which made perfect sense.
Right.
But then they also, and they gave me jurisprudence, which made sense also. I'd done that kind of work at Oxford. But Then they gave me evidence.
Yeah.
I'd never been in a trial courtroom in my life. And here I was supposed to teach people about hearsay and all that. And I limped through one case ahead of them, and they knew I didn't know anything about the subject. But being UVA students, they were so civilized and so kind. And I would use gimmicks. I survived, but I handed that course over.
Well, my commercial law course was negotiable instruments, which is a very specialized uniform commercial law course. Now, today, at that time, there was a different uniform law, the uniform governing negotiable instruments only. And so I taught the old NIL, if you will, the old negotiable instruments law. And I taught it like a jigsaw puzzle. And I didn't know anything about commercial law, nor did I much care, but it was a very integrated, complicated statute. And so we played with the statute, and I put the jigsaw puzzle together, and that was the...
But I think these must be fairly typical stories of that era.
Yeah, I think
so. Professors were not quite fungible commodities, but it came close.
Pretty close, yeah.
And if they had a need, they would simply fill it with you.
Right.
That person. Today, it's...
On the other hand, I will say, and that's there are a lot of factors that led to this, and in both Dick's case and mine, it was not difficult for us over the course of 3 or 4 years to gravitate towards the things we were interested in. And so he was able to get rid of evidence, I was able to get rid of negotiable instruments, and we picked up teaching packages that were compatible to what we wanted to do.
It's also easy to pitch a proposal to create a new course, new subject.
Absolutely.
I taught the law school's first environmental law course, and that was in the late 60s, before the first Earth Day, before we had NEPA, the Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, none of those existed. And I just thought it would be kind of a neat idea. Dennis Barnes, a chemistry professor, and I created this course, and we thought we'd get a half a dozen eccentric students sitting around my fireplace drinking port or something, and to my horror, 80 people signed up, and I had to get really serious about it. And so we invented a course when there was no material, no casebooks or anything.
Of course, that's still possible. That's one of the nice things about this law school. I did the same thing about 5 years ago, just invented a new course, and it's a very casual process here.
You know, one of the things that strikes me, I think about the catalog in those days, Peter pointed out, 2 years of required courses, students today would rebel the attitudes of required courses.
Right.
The required courses have become fewer and fewer, and at the same time, the number and range of electives has just exploded.
Right. And conversely, the reason the faculty could be so small when we started is that you only had 1 year of electives, and so the students, you know, you could have a bunch of courses, but they only had so many hours to only 1 year to fill. And whereas today they've got 5 semesters, basically, not completely, but almost 5 semesters to fill. Half of the spring of the first year, and then all of the second and third year. The first few years, when we abolished the required courses, the requirements, not the courses. The courses obviously were still offered, but the student enrollment patterns didn't change much. There were a couple of courses. Trust and Estates, for example, I think took a hit pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. That's a reasonably specialized course for certain niche of practice, but the basic required courses were, you know, the old NIL course disappeared. It was subsumed in the Uniform Commercial Code, and everybody took a UCC course then, and most people take it today.
Exactly. You know, Peter mentioned constitutional law. I taught it from the first year. And the coverage then spanned what today would be several different courses.
That's another interesting point,
The first-year con law course, which is pretty much federalism, 14th Amendment, structural things, plus all of what today would be the First Amendment course, plus what would be the criminal procedure course, I mean, plus federal courts, a lot of federal courts. I mean, it showed the shallowness of my knowledge that I could get through all that, but you know, the breadth of the terrain was vast then, and increasingly that course has become more focused on the courses have been spun
and
off.
Criminal procedure is another good example of that, because I taught 1 hour, that was the whole That was all there was of criminal procedure in the curriculum, was that 1 hour in the fall of the first year. And today there are multiple criminal procedure courses because that topic has exploded. And the same is true with the First Amendment has exploded, for example. The same is true of a lot of areas of constitutional law.
You think of the number of legal issues which, when we began teaching, were distant from the Constitution, which have now been constitutionalized.
That's true. Right.
The law of libel, for example, is not constitutionalized until 1965 with New York Times versus Sullivan. Right. Up to that point, it was pretty much state law.
Right.
That would just be one of many examples one could think of. Peter and I both served on a committee that inquired into the question of students wanting to sit on faculty committees. Now, why any student in his right mind would want to sit on a faculty committee? I don't know. I mean, I would happily just say to a student, you want a seat? You can have my seat. He would give it back. But anyway, we had a committee to study whether students should be on faculty committees, and you will recall that we agreed that they should be voting members of all committees except two, and they would be advisory members to appointments and admissions. It'd be more subsidiary role, but otherwise they'd be voting members, which I guess is still generally the case. And I think the 60s were a time, obviously the law school was not rocked like Berkeley or Columbia or the like, but there was a sense that students should have more choice, fewer requirements, that somehow required courses were onerous. And I'm not saying that's the driving force, but it was certainly parallel with that trend towards more options for students, essentially.
And Vietnam was not irrelevant. And the whole social revolution, if you will, that accompanied the
trivial things. Coats and ties disappeared by 1970.
That's right. Dick and I wore coats and ties to class every day as students.
Correct. And that was the norm.
Right, absolutely.
That was the norm.
Right, yeah.
And that survived the mid-60s. It really went about the time of Kent State and Vietnam and all of that.
Right. No women to speak of. I think I told you the other day at lunch that there were two women in my class. I don't know how many there were in yours. One black, one African American student in my class. So that the demographics in that sense have changed dramatically. And it wasn't in either of those cases. It wasn't because there were any exclusionary policies. It was just the culture and the choices were different.
Exactly.
Women just didn't want to go to law school at that point.
Peter may correct me.
I won't say there weren't any barriers, but there was no. They were subtle barriers and not formal barriers, if you will.
At least we accepted women.
Yeah.
College didn't have women until 1970.
Well, that's true. That's
and then
true.
By federal true. District court order.
Undergrad was that's right, was not co-ed.
But I was thinking that...
My wife, in fact, graduated from the University of Virginia before it became co-ed. Because she was... when I was a student here, I got married the summer before I started law school, and she had 1 year to go in college, and so she transferred to UVA, and she had to switch her major from psychology to education, because education and nursing were the only schools that at UVA at that point that took women.
The only undergraduate.
Only undergraduate schools, right. Graduate schools took women, but not the undergraduates. And there were a number of the Ivy League schools were not co-ed at that point either. That was UVA was not an outlier on that issue. And they all became co-ed about the same time, around 1970 or so.
The university was such a smaller place in those days,
absolutely.
1,000 students, and it had much more the feel of a private university about it. I mean, it felt more like, you were at Princeton, probably felt more like Princeton than it does today. And it had, I thought, more of a distinctly Virginia cast about it than more students who came from and went back to small towns.
That's probably true.
I've not quantified that. I don't know that's a statistical fact, but I just had the impression I had more fellow students from Danville or Lynchburg or those towns.
So the student body was dramatically different. The faculty was dramatically different. The physical facilities were dramatically different. The old Clark Hall location was a rabbit warren. kind of quaint and colorful one, but it was the facilities here are just so much better.
They are now. They weren't in 1974.
They weren't when we first moved. That's correct.
We moved into the original, what is now Withers Brown. It had the feel of a high school building about it.
Yeah, I used to call the architecture Modern American High School.
Exactly. Yeah. One long building with lockers and all that.
It was just a rectangle. That's all it was. Yeah.
I think it's a mixed blessing that we moved. We were able to create the campus we now have, which we could not have done over on the main grounds. But the downside was being separated from the university itself.
Right.
Because in those days, there was so much, you were so close to the main grounds, 2 minutes walk. And I felt there was more student and faculty concourse between the arts and sciences on
Absolutely.
The one hand and law on the other, which I think enriched our life at Clark Hall. I miss that stuff.
Well, that's the cost of moving out here. There have been many benefits, but that's a serious cost. And it has hurt, for example, interdisciplinary programs.
Exactly.
It's much more difficult for a student here to take a philosophy course or history course now than it would have been in those days. There's more of it now because the world is just more interdisciplinary. But there was a lot more commerce, if you will, among the laws of the schools then than there.
When I taught that environmental law course, about half the students in there were from other departments.
Yeah, sure.
A wonderful mix of students. And I, at lunchtime, could walk over to the Colonnade Club in 5 minutes and just sit down at a table with whoever was there, philosopher, theologian, whatever. There's a certain richness to that, which is hard to replace. But the trade-off is a wonderful building. I mean, wow.
Well, and my memory is that the university at that time made the judgment that as the university grew, which it was doing a bit then, it made sense to congregate the undergraduate part of the university at the core and move the graduate schools to the periphery. And I can't fault that judgment.
Yeah. And it was coincident with precisely 1970 when women were admitted as undergraduates. You doubled the potential. They weren't going to keep the college the same size and not admit all the men who might have come otherwise, so they had to expand.
That was the strategy when they admitted women. They just basically doubled the size of the university and accepted the same number of men and then an equal number of women, basically.
I would have moved the medical school out to a new campus. I've been czar of the university. I mean, just completely. And then kept that plant for the arts and sciences. But wasn't my decision. I was not teaching any seminars for the first decade, I would say. I don't think I taught a seminar until the 1970s.
I agree. I didn't either. Yeah. First seminar I taught was with Monrad Paulson when he was dean, which would have been late 60s, early 70s.
I think my first seminar, it was a Burker Court seminar. It wasn't until there was a Burker Court, so that had to be after 1969.
In fact, I can tell you, what's the date of Roe? Is it 70?
73.
73. All right, that's the first seminar that I taught.
There you are. Because, so it's about the same time.
Yeah, because the reason I remember that is that Monrad and I agreed to teach a seminar on the Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. And what we did is our students subscribed to U.S. Law Week. Mm-hmm. And at that time, the Supreme Court would decide real cases, if you will, all throughout the term. They didn't stack everything up until June or July. And so we scheduled this seminar that we were going to do on the current cases before the Supreme Court. We were just going to do whatever they did as they came down. And the first case was Roe.
Oh, wow. Wow, what a start. That's impressive.
I think I'm right about that. The date of Roe was January, wasn't it, or February?
I think it's January of 73.
Yeah,
I think you're absolutely right.
Exactly. So it was the first case that hit us. Of course,
what a start.
What a start, exactly. and there weren't, I think also, at least in the required curriculum days, there weren't very many seminars.
Right?
I took one or two as a student. I took an antitrust seminar that Covington and Burling taught, and Gerard.
I took the civil liberties seminar that
Dave Isbell
was taught at Dave Isbell, and before him, Charlie Horskin.
Right. And I took a seminar from Dick Spiedel in government contracts. But
there weren't many.
I probably had only two seminars as a student.
Indeed, at one time, this must have been the 1980s, they were trimming back on seminars. Being discouraged. Now it's quite the other way. Sensibly, it's the other way around. Yes, the explosion of the number of courses has included, in particular, a lot of some, which I think is healthy to give.
And also the number of adjuncts has increased enormously. I mean, there were some adjuncts at the time. That antitrust seminar that I took was an adjunct. The civil liberties seminar Dick took was an adjunct. But there were very few adjuncts at that time. And today there must be 50 or 60, I don't know. But a bunch.
And short courses didn't exist then.
That's right.
And January term didn't exist then.
Short courses.
So they add to the options.
And importantly, the small section was a later development. I don't remember exactly. I can't put a date on the small section. But when we started, the classes were just divided in half, basically. And you probably had half the con law students, and someone else had the other half. And same in criminal law for me. The concept of the small section came, I don't know, probably 10 years after we started, something like that. And that was a hugely important development in my view. I think that as the law school grew in size, I think that played a very important role in preserving a sense of smallness from the student perspective.
Thinking about life then and now, I was thinking of the driving here today, one thing that struck me was student life. That when I was a law student and started teaching, the student legal forum was about the only game in town.
Yeah.
And now you pass through the corridors and it's plastered with posters. There's a group for an organization for every discrete and insular group you can think. Every kind of law in this and law
in
that.
And in our day, one journal, the Law Review.
One journal.
The Law Review is the only
six.
Law Review and the Law Weekly were the only writing opportunities that students had.
Exactly. So life was more, I guess, classroom intensive in those days because there wasn't much else.
Right.
And also Charlottesville, my goodness.
Oh, yeah.
Still a small town in those days. You had one or two decent restaurants and not much to do. Now it's Broadway and Georgetown all wrapped up into one.
I believe, Dick will correct me, but I believe that 29 North stopped at the Barracks Road corner.
Correct. Barracks Road was created, the shopping center was created two years before you and I started teaching, 1962 was when it was created. And up to that you had what was then the Thomas Jefferson Inn, now FEI, Carroll's Tea Room.
Right. Carroll's Tea Room was on the corner there.
From there on out, it was verdant countryside.
Nothing, no development along 29 North at all, after Barracks Road.
And we had Main Street instead of the downtown mall.
That's right, exactly.
So the university was just, it was a courthouse and a few houses down at that end, a university at this end. All of which, I mentioned that because it means that if you were a law student here, it reinforced the sense that this was your life. You had to get in your car.
Although I do remember another point of commonality, and that is in my student days and my early faculty days, the football team was in an enormous losing streak.
Yes, that hasn't changed, has it? Some things don't change.